MacCast, Sunday, March 25th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. I got a good show for you today. We're going to be talking, of course, about the new iPad. It's been a week or so since it was released. Well, actually, just a little over a week. And we've been hearing reports of people's experiences with them, some reviews, some of the issues. We're going to be talking about some of the features and specs. A lot of people are benchmarking it and getting an idea of how the new iPad is stacking up against the old ones and how it's performing, also sales numbers and all those sorts of things. So lots of fun stuff there. Also some new rumors surrounding new iPhones, new MacBook Pros, that and a whole bunch more. I also have some great feedback from you. We're going to talk about the music app and some new features in the podcasting functionality, and also some bugs that I've run across and a couple of you run into as well, some potential fixes there. Also, talk a little bit about Wi-Fi issues. Some people reported having Wi-Fi issues with the new iPad, so I thought it's a great opportunity for us to discuss a little bit of troubleshooting and a bunch of other tips and tricks coming at you in a minute. Also, I have a review. I don't do too many reviews, but Elgato has a new Thunderbolt SSD drive, and I was able to get my hands on one to do a little bit of testing, so I'll let you know how that worked out. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, actually a new sponsor to the MacCast, and that's VMware. You may or may not know VMware. They make a great product for the Mac called VMware Fusion 4, and it makes it really easy to be able to run Windows and Mac applications side by side. So this is great, especially if you're coming over from Windows or you have the need to run a Windows application on occasion, rather than having to reboot your whole system into something like Boot Camp, you can just run VMware Fusion and have that stuff running side by side. You can also run other guest operating systems. You can do Linux. You can run OS X Lion, other versions of OS X if you need to do that for whatever reason. It's great if you're a web developer or a programmer and you need to test cross platforms because you don't have to reboot. You don't have to take all that extra time. And the latest version of VMware Fusion has over 90 new and improved features. It's fully optimized for multi-core Macs, so it takes full advantage of all that performance. It's OS X Lion compatible, and you can even use all the built-in Lion features with your Windows applications. So you can do things like add Windows programs to Launchpad. You can access Windows apps from Mission Control. You can view them in the full screen native mode that's built into Lion and switch between them with gestures. So you get all that great functionality. So all the experience of a Mac, but you're running those Windows applications that you may need to run. And it's really designed to give you the best Windows experience possible in OS X. And right now, until the end of the year, VMware Fusion 4 is being offered at a discounted price, $49.99. That's $30 off the original price, which was $79.99. So you can save some money. You can download a free trial from their website, and you can also purchase VMware Fusion 4 over at vmware.com/Mac. And it gets even better than that because they gave me a promo code, the promo code MacCast. If you use that when you make your purchase, you're going to get another 10% off that already discounted price. So it's a really great deal. If you've been thinking about virtualization software, you should check it out, vmware.com/Mac. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So the new iPad has been out for about a week now, and it's selling very well. As a matter of fact, it's selling like, well, I think we need to change that saying now, right? They're selling like iPads. I was going to say selling like hotcakes, but no, they're selling like iPads. Apple reported selling over 3 million iPads in the opening weekend, the first weekend of sales. That's the fastest sales rate for an Apple launch of iPads yet. Analysts are actually estimating that in the second quarter, they expect iPad sales to be between 11 to 13 million units. So depending on which analyst you're talking to. So we'll just call it around 12 million units is about the average that they're expecting. And that would represent a year-over-year iPad sales growth, unit sales growth of 156%. So that is just astronomical. And I was trying to wrap my head around that. And to put things into perspective, I ran across a piece that pointed out that Andy Rubin, Senior Vice President of Mobile at Google, said in February that by the end of February, Google had sold 12 million Android tablets, or there were 12 million Android tablets total out there in the marketplace. So Apple is set to sell that many iPads in one quarter. So it really gives you this idea of how many iPads they're actually selling and how much market share Apple really has in the tablet space. Friday, as a matter of fact, the iPad launched in an additional 25 countries. And so this is the fastest rollout for Apple ever, the most countries they've ever rolled out into this quickly. And despite all of the high sales volume and this large international rollout, supplies actually still seem to be really good. Most retail locations, as far as I've heard, seem to have iPads in stock. You can go into most Apple retail stores and pick one up. Looking at Apple's online site, it looks like the ship times for the U.S. right now are between 1 to 2 weeks on the delivery time, so not too much of a delay in online orders, and stores seem to be having a pretty good supply of shipments. So that's good news if you've been thinking about an iPad 3. We're going to talk a little bit in this episode of whether or not you necessarily need an iPad 3 or not. You know, the reviews have come in and they're generally positive. I mean, everybody's saying the iPad 3 is a great device, and it absolutely is. There's a few concerns back and forth. One thing that I think I've talked about a little bit but was pointed out in David Pogue's review is because of the Retina display, app sizes are going up as developers push out new Retina-optimized apps. And I noticed this week that my app updates are coming really quickly. So developers have really wholeheartedly jumped on the bandwagon and are updating their graphics and their assets so that they look the best that they possibly can on the new Retina display. But that means that if you have an older device, you're getting those same app updates. So your file sizes are going up as well, and you're not really getting the advantage of the higher-end images. They're being actually scaled down to fit onto your device. So it's just something to be aware of. It's probably going to make app management a little bit trickier for owners of older devices, and hopefully Apple will do something to kind of address that, but I'm not really sure how they could do it. It'd be a big technical challenge, but maybe there's something tricky they can do with sort of stripping out assets that would require developers to actually produce both resolutions, which right now I think that's nice because Apple did the design in a way that it just quadruples the number of pixels, basically 2 times scales the graphics assets, then it makes it really easy for a developer to roll in new assets. But right now, most of them are just putting in the new assets and letting those roll back gracefully to the older devices, which does affect the app size. Just something to be aware of as you're downloading all these new app updates. The Retina display, I think, is by far the biggest new feature on the iPad. Well, it could arguably be that. I think dictation and the new cameras are also very nice, but most people are pointing to the Retina display as the big update. Now, when you look at it, if you know what you're looking at, it is impressive. The text is clear and sharp and crisp, but if you take the screen and you put it side by side with the iPad 2 and you show it to most people who don't know, they have a hard time discerning the difference. You have to look pretty closely to see the advantage of the new Retina display. And Seth Weintraub pointed this out in his 9 to 5 Mac review. I think he put it correctly in saying, you know, it's not a life-changing experience like a lot of people have described. It is very good. It is excellent. I don't want to cause any misconceptions about that, but the question is it really enough for the majority of users? Geeks like us are going to love it. You know, absolutely. I don't know that I could go back, but you know, your mom or your grandma or your brother, your sister, your uncle might not actually see the same thing that you're seeing. And that's just something to be aware of as you're kind of reading through the reviews and things like that. And so as I've spent now a week with the new iPad, I really kind of concur with some of the things that are being said, that this is really a good evolutionary step in the evolvement of the iPad, but I don't think it's anything revolutionary. I'm not sure it's an absolute must-have, but if you don't have an iPad, you have an iPad 1, this is a fabulous upgrade, and I have a feeling a lot of people are taking advantage of that, and certainly the numbers support that. And, you know, on the hardware side, we're now starting to get that deeper analysis of what's inside the iPad. iFixit and the other groups have done their teardowns. We're getting a lot more details about what's going on. to that end. With respect to the Retina display, it was thought at launch that Apple was going to be using three suppliers, LG, Sharp, and Samsung. Later came out that maybe Samsung was the sole supplier because the other two manufacturers reportedly were failing to meet the quality standards that Apple had for the new display. Well, DigiTimes this week reported that LG and Sharp supposedly have begun shipping a small volume of displays for the new iPad. And that's good news because more displays in the chain means that Apple will be able to continue to keep up with the strong demand that we're seeing for the new iPad. On the battery side of things, some information came out with the respect to the new battery, which is much, much larger. I mean, the new iPad is pretty much, when you open it up and you see the iFixit pictures, it's all battery in there. As a matter of fact, the new iPad battery has about 70% higher capacity, and it really needs it because that Retina display has two backlights and takes about 7 watts of power compared to the iPad 2's about 3 watts, 2.7 to 2.8 watts of power. So it's doubled. Everything's kind of doubled with the new iPad in terms of battery, you know, 70%, not quite double the capacity, double the backlights, double the display resolution, quadruple the number of pixels, double the cores on the GPU or quad core. I think the old one had a dual core GPU. So everything is just more with the iPad 2, but it translates to what's required to drive that new display. And so along with that, logical things happen. Apple ships the same wall charger with the new iPad. So there's been reports this week that the new iPad takes quite a bit longer to reach a full charge compared to the iPad 2. It takes about 7 hours versus the iPad 2's 4-hour charging time. And when I read this, I thought, you know, that's probably not an issue for most of us. If you're like me, the iPad battery lasts so long, I'll go several days before I even need to charge it. So very rarely am I ever running or rushing to get the iPad charged. When I notice it's getting kind of low, I just think, oh, I'm going to have to plug it in tonight. And you plug it in when you go to sleep, and when you wake up in the morning, it's fully charged. So whether that took 4 hours or 7 hours, I would never really even notice. So I think for most people, that's not going to be a big issue. Now, one interesting thing related to the iPad being charged is DisplayMate was doing some testing this week, and they found out that the new iPad's battery indicator will indicate that it's fully charged actually about 2 hours before it actually is. So they were testing and saw that the indicator reported 100% charge, and then charging slowed down, and the unit continued to charge up the battery for another 2 hours and didn't reach its full actual capacity until that point. And they said that, you know, this isn't necessarily a problem with the new iPad, that all tablets and smartphones actually seem to exhibit this behavior in one form or another. DisplayMate says that it's generally a problem with the algorithm that's used to calculate the full charge percentage. So all the different factors they're factoring in, they make some math errors. Sounds like a significant one, but ultimately, I guess they all suffer from this problem, and it is something that Apple could correct in software. You know, I think that I've read places before that modern rechargeable batteries really perform best when you kind of bounce them or cycle them between not quite 100% charge and not quite 0%. So I've read reports that keeping the electrons flowing, cycling your batteries on your devices between 10 to 20% on the low end and 80 to 90% on the high end actually creates longevity in the battery life. So I half wonder if Apple didn't do something like this on purpose so that you're not constantly maxing out the charge on your device and then running it all the way down to zero, because I think that is harder on the long-term battery life. But that's just something that I heard somewhere. I don't have hard evidence to back that up. So if you happen to be a battery engineer and know about this kinds of technology, if I've gotten that wrong, let me know. Maccast@gmail.com is the email address you can send to me. Another thing somewhat related to charging is that apparently some third-party cables may not charge the new iPad or may not be working to charge the new iPad at the same rate. Jason O'Grady over at O'Grady's Power Page noticed that his iPad stopped charging at about 85% and then displayed that no charging indicator up in the menu bar. Even though he was using the 10-watt power brick that came with the device, he was using a longer, heavier gauge cable, a non-Apple cable, And I guess what the issue is that while the wall charger says it's 5.1 volts at 2.1 amps, it's outputting a fair amount of current, that seems to work fine if you're over a short, thin cable, but potentially with longer, thicker cables, it might not be able to draw as much power as it needs. So you end up getting that indicator, which if you check Apple's support website, that will come up any time that the iPad doesn't get that sort of full capacity, that full draw that it's expecting. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's not charging. It's just charging at a slower rate. So that's always been that kind of confusing message, because if you plug your iPad into your Mac, into the USB ports on your Mac, I think those are around five volts at 1 amp. So it's this lower rate and you get that message, but your iPad's still charging. It's just charging at about half the rate that it normally would. So the wall charger is always the best way to charge it up. And it sounds like the wall charger with the Apple supplied cables is the best method for the new iPad. Just something to be aware of if you want to get the fastest charging time. And also it sounds like you may want to leave it plugged in for an extra couple hours if you want to get the battery up to that full 100% charge. We'll have to see if Apple responds to or adjusts that algorithm at all, maybe in a future software update. Of course, as discussed earlier, the Retina display is getting a lot of analysis in terms of the sharpness of the text and things like that, just the clarity of the display, the number of pixels. But another area that's gone under deep analysis this week is the color accuracy. I think you heard us talk a little bit about this on the last MacCast, specifically when I was talking to Jeff Gamet. He really felt that the display was trending toward the warmer tones, and I saw something very similar. Definitely, if you hold it up next to an iPad 2 display, the iPad 2 is very blue, where the new iPad is much more in the yellow, warm tones. Jeff kind of was feeling it was almost too yellow, but DisplayMate was running their tests this week, and they claim that the color accuracy of the new iPad is phenomenal. It's probably the best it could be, according to them. They also confirmed in their teardown reports that there are three suppliers, and there were three suppliers at launch of the displays, Samsung, LG, and they say possibly Sharp. But when they did their kind of spectrum deep analysis, and this is like lab testing kind of analysis of the accuracy of the colors and just the color space itself, the number of colors that the display can reproduce, they say the iPad 3 has very accurate colors and picture quality, almost likely better and more accurate than any display you own. That's almost a direct quote, according to them. They say, unless you have a professionally calibrated display, and most of us, let's be honest, don't have that. If you're an artist or a photographer, you may have had your display professionally calibrated, but they're saying out of the factory, how Apple's calibrated the iPad, the new iPad displays, they say it reproduced 99% accurate color reproduction, and they say it beats every laptop, tablet, and mobile projector that they've seen. So they were very impressed by it. They also claim that the upscaled graphics on the new iPad look very good, and we found out some details about that, why that might be, because it seems that Apple did something very smart. In cases where an app developer had already generated Retina graphics for the iPhone 4, they're using those graphics to do their upscaling to the new iPad resolution rather than relying on the original iPad 2 resolution images and scaling those up. So you're getting very good, close to fully Retina optimized graphics on the iPad 2. And that's obviously having a good effect. Now, as you can imagine, driving all those pixels, those extra backlighting, even though you got that bigger battery, that does have a bit of an impact on the real-world performance, at least in DisplayMate's testing on the battery life of the new iPad. They claim the iPad uses about 2.5 times the backlight power of the iPad 2 at the same screen brightnesses. And so in their testing, running time at maximum brightness on the new iPad was about 5.8 hours, and that translates to about 20% less of the battery life that they were seeing in the iPad 2, which came in at about 7.2 hours. And I'm thinking, you know, 5.8, that's right around 6 to 7.2, an hour difference in battery life. That's going to be significant for some people. But overall, in my day-to-day usage of the new iPad, I haven't noticed that it's all that much different than my old one. It did seem that I was having to probably charged up every 2 days versus 3 days, something like that. But I've also been using it more heavily than I had been using my iPad 2 in the past, just because, you know, you want to play with the thing. You got a new toy. You got to run it through its paces. So we'll have to see in a couple of weeks when things mellow out if I still feel the same about the battery life. Let's talk a little bit about the processor, the A5X processor that's in there. It came out now that it's been tore down and looked at and analyzed under microscopes and things like that, that thing is huge. And not just in terms of performance, it's actually physically very big. Even though it's built on the same 45 nanometer architecture that the A4 chip was built under, the A4 chip was about 53.3 millimeters square. The A5X is 165 millimeters, so much, much bigger in terms of physical size. So you have to imagine that, you know, Apple's cramming bigger components in, and they really didn't have to add much thickness or much size to the iPad 2. So there's some amazing feats of engineering going on inside there to cram all that stuff in there. I think iFixit even pointed out that, you know, teardown on the iPad is getting more and more difficult with every iteration, because I think they're having to use more glue. You know, this thing's just like sandwiched together to get everything in there as tightly packed as possible. So it is making repair and upgrading and stuff like that a little more tricky if you're one of those DIY type people. But the processor itself is using the same dual-core 1 gigahertz CPU, and then you have the quad-core GPU crammed on top of that. You know, that's what's really needed to drive the 4 times the number of pixels. You got 4 cores, 4 times the number of pixels. And so in terms of actual performance, the GPU seems to be dedicated mostly to driving that Retina display, and it's probably not going to translate into a lot of real-world higher performance numbers when compared to the iPad 2. And I think we're kind of seeing that in some of the benchmark tests. The one area that Apple did do a nice little bump up is in the RAM. The new iPad is confirmed to have double the RAM, 1 gigabyte versus the 512 of the iPad 2. There were some reports this week that some people with new iPads but older smart covers were having issues where the sleep wake on off feature when you close and open the cover wasn't working properly for them. And it was also reported that some third party cases that had that feature built into it were also not working. One of the people who was suffering from this problem did a little bit of tear down and analysis on his own and discovered that it looks like the new iPad is polarity sensitive when it comes to the magnets that are built in to the smart cover for activating that feature. So that switch really does depend on polarity, and I guess some of the early Apple covers and maybe some third-party covers are polarized in the wrong way, so that's causing that feature not to work. So I just wanted to point that out in case you ran across a case and for some reason it wasn't working. Just as a side note, though, I want to say that I have the smart cover on my new iPad, and mine seems to pop off much easier than it did on my iPad 2. It's always been a problem with the smart cover. I think the magnets aren't on there quite, you know, strongly enough, at least for my tastes or how I use it. Very often I'll be using it on my lap or in bed, and then the cover will just kind of pop off. That seems to be happening more readily with the new iPad, and I'm half wondering if that doesn't have to do with the added thickness and the more gradual curve of the back case, and it just not quite, you know, sort of sandwiching that tightly against the back. But that's just my own personal theory. I haven't heard anybody else really mentioning that. I'd love to, if you've noticed the same thing, if you could let me know, or if you think I'm crazy, let me know that as well. Another thing that was very interesting is if you have the new 4G LTE iPad, I would have assumed that Apple would finally open up the ability to do FaceTime over the cellular networks. Apparently that hasn't been enabled yet, so you're still locked to only Wi-Fi on FaceTime. Not really sure why that is, if that's a carrier restriction or an Apple restriction. Hopefully at some point they'll be able to lift that. I think technically, you know, 4G should work very well for doing FaceTime calls, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that'll want to do that, especially if the new iPhone ends up being on 4G. So that was kind of some of the updates with respect to the hardware, some of the software features and things like that. I think this all comes down to is, you know, if you're in the market for a new iPad or thinking about upgrading, should you buy the new iPad or should you stick with what you have? Should you maybe buy the iPad 2, which is now cheaper? I think for this round, I'm having a hard time really recommending to a whole lot of people that they upgrade to the iPad 3, especially if they already have and are happy with an iPad 2. I was telling you earlier how a lot of consumers can't really see the difference between the two displays. So if you are an iPad 2 owner thinking about upgrading because you want that Retina experience, I would encourage you, take your iPad 2 into an Apple retail store, put them side by side, and run through some of the applications, some of the normal operations that you do on your iPad, and see if it really makes a difference to you. Also, you know, if you care about the cameras, you know, some people really want a better camera in there, play around with those. Just take it for a test drive. I don't know that it's, like I was saying, this absolute must have to get this. Bare Feats, which is a great website for benchmarking, barefeats.com, that's B-A-R-E-F-E-A-T-S, barefeats.com, they showed that CPU performance is almost identical, which would be expected. It's the same dual core 1 gigahertz CPU, and that GPU performance, as I was mentioning earlier, is mostly used up driving the Retina display. So double the RAM is going to help on the performance side a little bit, but it's really not going to be this life-changing, life-altering jump in performance. I think gaming is going to get better in terms of visuals, but probably not astronomically better because, again, a lot of that GPU is being used up by the operating system to drive the display. So bottom line is, if you really, really want the Retina display quality, if you're really into the new cameras or you need the 4G LTE support, then iPad, the new iPad, that's the way to go, third generation iPad. But in a lot of cases, I have a feeling the iPad 2 might be a better deal for most people because you're going to get similar performance at a lower price point. So it's going to be a tough call for a lot of people. But I think this time around, I'm going to be recommending to a lot of people that this is a nice-to-have update, not necessarily a must-have. So that's the new iPad and everything we know so far. But, you know, what about the next iPhone? What's the next big thing coming from Apple? Would it surprise you if I said that the next iPhone is arriving in the fall, around October or so? I don't think, if you're an Apple fan and if you've been listening to the show for any amount of time, I don't think that's going to come as any kind of surprise to you. Would it surprise you if I said it's going to have LTE? No, probably not going to surprise you if I tell you that either. But it does get some of the rumor sites excited. Actually, they've been poking around in the latest iOS 5.1 beta software, and they found references to 4G on the iPhone. And immediately some of them start saying, oh, that 4G LTE is definitely coming on the next generation iPad. But I read another report that seems to make more logical sense, that it's likely just referring to the newly rebranded AT&T 3G. Now it's 4G HSPA Plus network stuff. I think despite that, though, there's no doubt that Apple's ready to go LTE. I think the iPad being on LTE is a good indicator of that, and I fully expect the next iPhone will have LTE support. One rumor that popped up early last week that I just immediately went, that's ridiculous, is that the new iPad was going to feature a 4.6-inch display. That is just massive, and I know that there's been some studies and reports saying that consumers like the larger displays, but honestly, have you been into a store and held one of these 4.5, 4.6, 4.7 inch screens? It's like holding a mini tablet to your face. I'm just not buying it. It's not what I want, I guess. And I just find it hard to believe that a majority of consumers really want that. I want a device that's pocketable. And I think iMore, and it came out rightly and said, you know, the new screen is going to be roughly the same size as the current screen, if not exactly the same. I think if Apple can push the screen out to the edge and maybe get into that 4-inch range, I might be able to buy that. I don't even see a need for that, though. I'm really happy with the size and form factor of the current iPhone. If it got a little bit thinner, maybe a little bit more durable on the glass, that would be awesome. I'd rather see Apple focus on really refining this form factor and making everything just a little bit better. But I don't see this need to go to these ginormous phones. I'm just not really buying it. Another feature that's being thrown out there that I'm just not sure how this is going to work out, but I think could come to light, is they're saying that there's going to be this new smaller dock connector. It just seems like a place we don't want to go to because we've had the 30-pin dock connector for so long. It's really become this kind of standardized interface. You have a lot of accessories that rely on it. I can understand the logic in going to a smaller connector because you could make a smaller potentially thinner device, but you're going to need, for a while at least, some sort of adapters and little dongles and stuff like that. It just clutters up the experience. So Apple's going to have a really good justification for going to a smaller connector. I know it doesn't scare them off. They will change specs and designs when they feel that they need to be changed. So if there is a really good reason from a design perspective for them to put in a new connector, I think it could happen and it might likely happen. One thing that I think a lot of people are very excited about, and I've always been mixed feelings on this, is haptic feedback. You know, that sort of thing where you touch the screen and it feels like you're actually touching a button even though there's no physical button there. And the problem I have with that is every implementation that I've ever seen of that up to this point has just been you touch the screen and the thing vibrates, it buzzes. It's really not simulating the feeling of actually touching a button. Well, Apple's filed a patent for some haptic touch technology, a haptic touch interface that would be different. I'm not saying it's going to be in the next iPhone, but a lot of people are hoping it will be because they use these piezoelectric actuators to actually localize the feedback. So it really, from what I understand, and I think they were demoing some of this kind of technology at CES, a couple people told me that it was really amazing. It would actually feel like a button. And part of what makes it work is, I guess, it's in its own kind of layer sandwiched on the screen, and that would even allow Apple to do some, potentially do some force sensors on that same layer to gauge how hard someone was pressing. So it sounds a little bit like pressure sensitivity to me. I think it's a little bit different than that, but that's some amazing technology, and that could take the display kind of to the next level and give Apple a leg up on some of the other phones and devices that are out there. So that would be interesting to see. I would like it only if it truly does feel like there's some physical tactile buttons there. I know for people who are touch typists, especially if that technology made its way to the iPad, that would help a lot in improving the keyboard, the on-screen keyboard experience on that device. So if Apple can pull it off, that would be great. But I'm not so sure it'll be in the next iPhone. But before we even get to the next iPhone, we are likely going to have some new computers coming our way. And speculation right now is that Apple is getting ready to release some new MacBooks, potentially this summer, along with the release of Mountain Lion. And the big focus, again, is going to be on the display technology. Everybody's expecting that there will be a high DPI Retina-style display making its way to the MacBook Pro line. And part of the thing that's fueling this is that in Mountain Lion, there's been some double-sized graphics and icons and things like that that have been showing up that seem to indicate Apple's getting ready for this kind of push forward. The rumors have been circulating for a while. There's even been rumors that Apple has some of these units in testing on their campus. Everybody's expecting that they're going to start with the 13 and the 15-inch MacBook Pros, which makes sense because those are the smaller size screens, because these displays are going to be very expensive to produce. Again, technology underlying this stuff is, you know, cramming all those pixels, as Apple pointed out in their video, is not an easy thing to do. And so that drives pricing and yields and stuff up on these displays. But they're expected that they'll also be thinner, Apple integrating more of the MacBook Air style technologies into the MacBook Pro line. And I will be very excited to see those units making their way out this summer if that does happen. Somewhat related to this, and I didn't even have this in the show notes, but I want to talk about it a little bit, is there's still a lot of questions about what Apple is going to be doing on the Pro side of things. And we really aren't hearing anything in the rumor mill related to the Mac Pro. It is way overdue for an update. I think we're also kind of overdue for some iMac updates, at least a little bump up or something like that. So I would expect that in the next few months, we'll be hearing more and more rumors related to the Mac side of the house. Now that we're past the iPad and we're kind of waiting until the fall on new iPhones, iPod touches, things like that, I think it's time we get back into some of the Mac rumors. And I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to hearing some of those. And hopefully it's going to start with some sort of update to the Mac Pro, but stay tuned for that. I'll be watching the feeds, scouring to find any kind of information that I can for you on that front, if it exists. One of the good things about being a Mac user, an Apple fan, is that we don't have to worry as much about security and exploits and things like that, but we occasionally do have stories that crop up that are of a concern. And we had one come up this week that I definitely needed to point out to you because this is a pretty big hole. There's a security researcher that discovered an issue with the address bar in Safari. And more specifically, this issue impacts all of WebKit, I believe. What he discovered was that he was able to load a website in mobile Safari while keeping the URL bar set to a different URL. So the exploit that he demoed showed Apple's website, or what looked like Apple's website, being served off of his server, loading in the browser, and then in the URL bar, it did actually say www.apple.com. So you could imagine if someone sent a link, they could spoof a banking website or a financial website or something like that using this trick. And it uses the JavaScript open function to load a new window or a tab after you click a specially crafted link. And that loads the site hosted on one server in an iframe while displaying another site's URL in the address bar. And hopefully Apple will come up with a patch for this exploit fairly quickly. It's been reported to them. But until that happens, I'm going to reiterate what you should always be doing anyway. Be careful about clicking any links or visiting any untrusted websites. So, you know, those short URL links, those are the ones that always worry me in Twitter and Facebook, and they're all over the web. Make sure that you know what you're clicking on before you click that. And hopefully we'll have a Safari update just around the corner here. Here's something interesting. Where did you buy your iPhone? If you own an iPhone, where did you buy that? There was an interesting report that came out this week, a survey actually of U.S. customers done by Consumer Intelligence Research Partners. They took a poll from December last year through February of this year, asking customers that exact question, where did you buy your iPhone? And they showed that just 15% of iPhone buyers actually bought the device directly from Apple. And I've always bought directly from Apple, so I guess that surprised me. When I really stopped to think about it, I probably shouldn't have been that surprised. They also noted that 13% had bought iPhones from Best Buy. And I don't know why they targeted Best Buy, I guess because they have the Apple store within a stores. They didn't really say what the other retailers, brick and mortar retailers that people bought iPhones from were, but it looks like a majority of customers actually buy directly from the carrier. And AT&T, I guess, sold about 32% of the iPhones to those customers who were surveyed. Verizon sold about 30%, and then Sprint came in at 7%, and then I would assume the other small percentage was those other sort of brick and mortar retailers. Another interesting fact that came out in the study is that apparently a majority of buyers get their iPhones from physical stores. I guess I'm not the average iPhone buyer because I bought online the last few times, but according to their study, 76% of purchasers actually purchased from traditional brick and mortar locations, while only 24% of customers bought online. So I just thought that was an interesting fact and surprised me a little bit. Another thing that surfaced this week that surprised me was an interesting fact about the new Apple TV user interface. Did you know that the new Apple TV UI was actually rejected by Steve Jobs like years ago? This fact actually surfaced this week on Twitter and was reported by The Next Web. Former Apple TV engineer Michael Margolis tweeted out that the new Apple TV update, version 5.0, actually uses designs that were tossed out 5 years ago because Steve Jobs didn't like them. He was also remarking that since Steve Jobs passed, apparently that there's nobody at Apple to say no to bad design. I don't know if I'd go that far. I kind of like the new Apple TV UI, but I guess later he clarified some of his statements saying that the new UI makes more sense now because there's a clear effort at Apple to make everything look and feel more like the iOS interface. So that kind of tile interface right at the home screen, almost mimicking what you see on the home screen of your iOS device, makes a little more sense at this point. He pointed out that when Jobs made his statement years ago, he didn't like that kind of grid structure, but that was really before the iPhone or iOS interface was really fleshed out. So I don't know. At the announcement, it seemed like Eddie Q and Phil Schiller were both very excited about the new UI. So maybe not going through the Steve Jobs filter was what made it happen. But more likely, it's just a generational thing that timing-wise, it makes sense for this UI to come forward. And I really do like the fact that it exposes a lot more of the functionality right up front of the Apple TV. I think it makes it much easier for people to find different features and things that they want to take advantage of. So we'll have to see if that translates into actual sales. You know, one of the things about the new Apple TV was that there was not a lot of significant changes, or there didn't seem to be a lot of significant changes from the old Apple TV. One of the big ones was that there is a new custom A5 chip in there. It's a single core A5 processor, but iFixit found some other significant hardware tweaks when they did their breakdown of the Apple TV. They say that it has the same Broadcom 4330 chip that is found in the new iPad. That's what allows all the different kinds of connectivity. They say the chip supports dual band 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz 802.11 A, B, G, and N, but also that same chip supports the Bluetooth 4.0 plus HS stuff. So that means that potentially Apple could turn on Bluetooth 4.0 support in the Apple TV. There's no word that they actually plan to do that, but it does seem like that leaves the room for some good potential that there could be Bluetooth accessories like keyboards or trackpads or even game controllers that could bring added functionality to Apple TV should Apple want to put apps on there. And I think that's a natural progression of the device. So if you are getting a new Apple TV and Apple does do a future software update, you might be able to take advantage of that stuff. And then finally, in the news for this week, it looks like Apple is going to get a new campus in Austin, or I guess I should say the city of Austin is going to get a new Apple campus in their city. City officials agreed to give Apple $8.6 million in incentives over the next 10 years. And that means Apple will move forward with construction of a new campus there. Apple is also getting an additional $21 million over 10 years from the Texas Enterprise Fund. The facility will begin construction later this year on 38 acres and is estimated to cost about $304 million. The campus is expected to focus on local customer support, sales, and accounting functions and will generate about 3,600 new jobs in the city. So that's really great news for Texas and the city of Austin. And really nice to see Apple continuing to grow, continuing to expand, and generating some new jobs in this economy. And so that'll do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment and thank another one of our show's sponsors, Smile. I've told you about Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, great Mac apps from Smile. You should check them all out. But this month, I'm just really excited about PDF Pen for the iPad. I told you about it. They launched it at Macworld, and I've been using it ever since. And, you know, it just has all of the best features of PDF Pen for the Mac, but on the go, on your iPad. You can do everything that you normally would want to do with those PDFs. You can edit and make text corrections. You can reorder and rearrange pages. You can add markup and highlighting and annotations and notes. It's really designed around the touch interface. They were very smart. You know, Smile makes great stuff. They're not going to cut corners and certainly haven't done so here. They just leverage the touch interface in a way that makes it really work. And doing the stuff that I do normally with PDF Pen, like adding signatures, so incredibly easy. I can sign right on the iPad. I can save that into an object library so that I have it to reuse, so I don't have to sign every single time. Simple little touches like that just make the application a joy to use. And another thing that you would commonly worry about is, well, how do I get PDFs in and out of it? You know, file management on the iPad has never been this great thing. PDF Pen on the iPad makes it really easy because they added the ability to open from and export to tons of different places. So it fits whatever workflow you might have. You can go from iTunes, iDisk, WebDAV, Dropbox support is in there, Evernote support is in there, FTP, Google Docs, whatever you use, you're going to be able to get your PDFs in and out. And they even have iCloud integration better than anybody else has currently right now because you can get it to and from the desktop. They have PDF Pen cloud access for iPad. You download that for your Mac. It's included with PDF Pen for the Mac if you're an owner of that product. And you can get access to your PDFs from the Mac, from your iPad, wherever you need to get access to those, and work with them in PDF Pen with all the same familiar tools and functionality that you're used to using. And right now, for a limited time, it's still just $9.99 on the App Store. So they've extended that limited time pricing. So if you haven't gone and picked it up yet, you really should. If you want to check out the rest of their products, get free trials of their Mac software. You can find more information and details at smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I normally don't like to kick off the feedback portion with my own kind of complaints or questions or concerns about software or something like that. But I'm going to in this case because I have something on my mind that's really been bugging me. You've been emailing me to let me know that you've noticed this as well. And unfortunately, it's something that broke in the music app with respect to podcasts in the latest software update, in the iOS 5.1 update. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm one of those people that does an enhanced podcast. So if you're listening to this and you're on your iOS device or you're listening to it in iTunes, you know that there are chapter markers, there's changing album art, there's hyperlinks to stuff that I'm talking about. So all these great enhanced features that Apple makes available in GarageBand, I put in there for you to be able to take advantage of. And chapters are a big deal for a lot of you. I recognize it gives you the ability to go back and find specific sections to jump to specific topics. If you're short on time and you want to jump right to something that I'm talking about, you can get there using those chapter markers. And a big part of that is the titles in each of those chapter markers. Well, a number of you have emailed me to say, why do my chapters now just say chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, instead of the great titles that you used to put in there? Guess what? I'm still putting them in there. They haven't gone away. I'm not slacking off, I promise you. I'm putting them in there. They're not displaying on the new music app and the updated music app with iOS 5.1. So if you've upgraded, you've lost that functionality. I'm hoping it's a bug. It's not something that Apple deliberately took out. Please tell Apple you want them to fix it. I've gone through my contacts at iTunes. I've emailed them directly, said, this is broken, please, please, please fix it. So I'm hoping there's going to be a software update, but send feedback to apple.com/feedback so we can get that functionality back, because I miss it probably just as much, if not even more than you do. So I just wanted to let you know about that. Overall, I've been frustrated with Apple's support for enhanced podcasts. You know, it takes me about an extra hour or so to put in all that added functionality in my production time. And I'm happy to do it because a lot of people really appreciate it. And unfortunately, the last few software updates, Apple keeps breaking that functionality. And it's functionality they pioneered, that's the most frustrating part for me, is it's built into GarageBand. They encourage us to use it. They ask us to use it. I've been using it for years. I'm one of the few podcasters that do. And now it seems like every iteration, they kind of break it. I had an issue for the longest time where my enhanced podcast, the AAC files, would not stream or download through the iTunes Store app. So I put all the functionality in there, and you'd go to stream it through the iTunes Store, and it would say the file format wasn't supported. Yet you could go subscribe to the feed, download exactly the same file, same format, same exact file off the same server, and it would run just fine once you synced up through iTunes. So it definitely wasn't a problem with the file format. It was a software problem. Good news is they are doing some updates that are actually improving things with the 5.1 update. If you're an iPad owner, you now have speed controls, the playback controls, so you can play back at 1x, 2x, 1/2x speed. And they also added the 30-second skip back feature in the music app on the iPad. So it's good to see that stuff is progressing, but still on the iPad, they don't support the changing album artwork. They don't support the hyperlinks. They don't support the chapter listings. So I don't know what's going on with Apple with respect to podcasts and AAC podcasts, but I think we need to start pushing on them and saying, we like this functionality. We want it to stay. We want you to continue to support it. So if you could help me out, please send some feedback, apple.com/feedback. And I know that I am not the only one to notice or be frustrated by these things. As a matter of fact, I got this comment from Adam.
Hey, Adam. This is Adam from Maryland. A couple weeks back, I'd emailed you on the tip of just the saving a picture and emailing it to yourself for the contacts app. Anyways, love the show, of course. Thanks again for all that you do with it. There's one thing that was particularly frustrating to me lately, and I feel like I heard you talk about it before, but I can't remember what it was, podcast controls on the music app. What happened to them? How do I get them back? It seems like they've been gone for so long. And more and more I'm missing them. So if you could let me know any insight that you have, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks, and best to you.
Yeah, I think the best thing you can do is just send email, contact Apple, apple.com/feedback, and let them know that you want that stuff. I think we all do. Another feature that I really would like to see, and many of you would as well, is support for protected RSS feeds. So people who subscribe to MacCast members can actually get the podcast directly through iOS, through Apple's built-in software. Until that happens, I'm starting to recommend to more and more people like yourself that you go with some of the great third-party apps that are out there on iOS devices for playing back and subscribing and finding podcasts. And there's two in particular that I really like. I know there's lots of options out there. So if you have one of your favorites and you want to give us a review or weigh in on that, please send in an audio comment or just drop a voicemail on the voicemail line. But I like Downcast and Instacast, both great apps. What's interesting is I like one on the iPad and one on the iPhone. I like Downcast on the iPad, but I like Instacast on my iPhone. And for those of you who don't know, Downcast on the iPad, it has some great features. Like it has the 30-second skip back, but it also has 15-second skip back and a 30-second and 2-minute skip forward. So if you want to jump forward, you can do that. You can download or stream podcasts through the app. So you don't have to download. You can just stream the MacCast. It has the playback speed controls. It has the chapter support. The full show notes are in there, so all the stuff that I put up on the website with all the hyperlinks, you don't have to go to the website to get it. You can get it right inside the app. It has cool features like a sleep timer. So if you're listening at night and you want your iPad to shut itself off or the application to shut itself down, you can set the sleep timer and it'll take care of that for you. Another really nice feature, and the one time that I do prefer Downcast on the iPhone is when I'm in the car, because they have these great gesture controls. You can put on this gesture mode and then the whole screen becomes a big tap surface. So you double tap to play or pause the podcast you're listening to. You can use two fingers to swipe left or right to jump between the chapters. So you don't have to look down at the display. You can just reach over. It makes it much safer for driving in the car. It has AirPlay support. About my only complaint with Downcast on the iPad is it doesn't have full-sized album art support. I'd like to see bigger album art on it. It also doesn't seem to support the hyperlinks, which is a bummer. I can't find that anywhere. If it's in the app and I'm just missing it, let me know, but I have not seen it in there. And both of these applications, Downcast and Instacast, have the ability to manually add a feed URL. And you can add a password-protected feed. So if you are a MacCast member, you can use either of these applications to subscribe to your MacCast member feed directly on the device. You just enter your username and password, and you can get that. Now, the reason I like Instacast on the iPhone as opposed to the iPad is that Instacast HD, the iPad version, seems more like this strange effort to kind of marry an RSS reader like Reader with a podcatcher. It's very focused on kind of a text interface. It has all the full show notes and stuff there. And then it also lists out all of the chapters kind of underneath that, but it's very textual, not very visual. It doesn't seem to take advantage of the iPad. It's almost like a scaled up version of Instacast. Almost all your controls are in this little bar on the left-hand side, and I just think they're not large enough. Another thing is that it's a separate purchase, so if you own Instacast, you need to get Instacast HD as a separate purchase on the iPad. With Downcast, it's a universal app, so you can use it across all the platforms. But Instacast on the iPhone is really nice because it does have the full-screen album art. It has a simplified playback mode that feels much more like the music app, and I like that a lot. Has all those other great features that Downcast has, the ability to download or stream the podcast. It does have the chapter markers, although they don't show the thumbnails, which I wish they would do. But it does have support for the hyperlinks in its playback. So if I'm talking about something, there's a hyperlink there, you can tap it and go right to it. As you're listening, they have the speed controls. It has the AirPlay support. Another nice feature of Instacast, especially if you use it cross-platform between an iPhone and an iPad, is they have integration with iCloud and Dropbox for syncing of your podcasts. So two great podcatching applications that you can use as alternatives to Apple's built-in music app. And I encourage you to do so because until Apple fixes a lot of the issues that they have with podcast playback, especially on the iPad, I think these are better alternatives and probably a better way to go. So I hope that helps you out, Adam. Some new iPad owners this week were reporting issues, troubles with their Wi-Fi connections. We once again kind of got these reports that occasionally the iPad would drop the Wi-Fi connection, wouldn't connect to Wi-Fi. The issue with the new iPads seems like it may be a bug in the software, although it's not impacting everyone. I haven't had any issues with my iPad, and I've asked a couple other people, and they haven't reported the problems, but there have been a couple threads in Apple's discussion boards, so something's going on there. But I thought it might be a great opportunity for us to just go through some troubleshooting tips, because it seemed like for the people that were being affected by it, some of the typical workarounds did seem to fix the issue, if not permanently, at least temporarily. So if you have run into Wi-Fi troubles, these tips, these tricks will help you regardless of what your device is, your Mac, your iPad, your iPhone, whatever it is, your iPod Touch, you might try some of these things. So the number one thing I think a lot of people forget about, especially if you have a third-party router, but even if you're using an AirPort, make sure you're up to date on your software. Update your firmware. Go into the web interface, go into AirPort Utility, double check, run your software updates, make sure that your router is completely up to date with all of its software updates, because sometimes something might change on Apple's end and suddenly there's a little bit of an incompatibility. Maybe the router manufacturer has already compensated for that or already had a fix for that and you're just not up to date. So a lot of people forget about that. And the next step, if it's not your firmware, if all your software is up to date, is maybe just reset your router. You know, just reboot it. You can do it if you have an AirPort. You can use the AirPort utility to go in and reset it. A lot of the other devices, you just unplug them, disconnect them from power, leave them off for a little bit, and then plug them back in. If you're specifically just having issues with your internet connectivity, it's not your local area network. So in other words, if you can still connect Macs together or from your iPad to your Mac on your Wi-Fi network over the LAN, you might try also resetting your cable modem or your DSL router. And again, it's typically the situation where you unplug it and you plug it back in. And personally, I like to do it in the order of going from the internet connection, the line coming into the house and working backwards. So I'll unplug my router, I'll unplug my cable modem, and then plug them back in. Cable modem, let that connect, and then plug my router in, and then turn on my Macs and let that connect to the router. And that usually resolves the issue a large portion of the time, specifically if it's related to my internet connection going down. But when it's a particular device or computer itself, if you've eliminated any issues that might be happening with your router or the internet connection coming into your house, in other words, you've done all those steps that I just talked about, you're now down to it's probably something on the individual device itself. And one thing that can help is just simply toggling the Wi-Fi on and off, disconnecting from the Wi-Fi network and reconnecting. It seems simple, but you know, you can do that in a couple ways. One really easy way is just reboot the device, reset the device. So if you're on an iOS device, hold down the home button and the sleep wake button, keep them held down until you see the Apple logo. If you're on your Mac, just simply restart it. See if that doesn't fix the issue. If you don't want to restart it, you could just toggle the Wi-Fi on and off in iOS. You just go into the settings under Wi-Fi and you'll see the switch there. Turn it off. I leave it off for about 10 seconds and then just flip it back on the Mac. You can just go under the Wi-Fi in the menu bar and switch it off, or go into the system preferences under network, select your Wi-Fi network, and you'll see the turn Wi-Fi off button. Turn it off, leave it off for a little bit, turn it back on. If that doesn't resolve the issue, the next step is you might want to go in and you know how when you connect to a Wi-Fi network, most of your devices, unless you've told them not to, will remember those networks. So the next time you come into that zone, into that network area, it will automatically try and connect to that network. Well, you can go in and implicitly tell the operating system to forget about that network and then kind of reestablish that connection, reset your password and stuff like that. And that can be helpful in these situations. On iOS, you want to go into settings under general, go into network, and then Wi-Fi. Find the Wi-Fi that you're currently connected to, and then tap the little blue arrow next to its name in the list, and that'll get you to a new screen. And then on that screen, you'll see an option that says, or a button that says, forget this Wi-Fi network. Tap that, and then click forget, and that will remove it from that known network list. And now you can go back and you can reconnect to that network. You're likely going to have to re-enter your network password, but once you've done that, that'll kind of reset things and reconnect you to the network, and hopefully it'll be working again. On the Mac, it's kind of a similar procedure. You go into System Preferences under Network, you select the Wi-Fi, and then you click the Advanced button, and then you need to find the network in the list of preferred networks. You see a list there in the middle of the screen. Select the one that you're connected to, and then down at the bottom, click the little minus button. That's going to remove that from the list of preferred networks, and then once again, go back through your network settings, reconnect to that network, and then re-enter your password, and you should be good to go again. Barring all that working, then you might need to start, you know, making calls to AppleCare. There could be potentially something wrong with your hardware. There is one more thing you can try if you're on iOS, though, and this is iOS only. You could go in and you can completely reset the network settings. To do this, you're going to go into Settings under General and then Reset. And then in that area, you'll see a button that says Reset Network Settings. You'll tap that button. But before you do, just know that that is going to wipe out all of your network settings and passwords for that device. So you're going to have to re-enter them. So do that. It'll reset all that stuff and then reboot your iOS device. Again, hold down the sleep wake button and the home button until you see the Apple logo, and then it'll reboot, and then you're going to have to reconnect, re-enter all of your network information, and hopefully that'll resolve your issue. I think you'll find that like 90% of the time, one of these tricks, one of these tips is actually going to resolve your network problems, and you'll be good to go again. But after that, if it's not working, then you likely have something more serious going on. You may try doing a full restore of your device, or in the case of OS X, reinstalling the operating system. I typically start with reinstalling the latest combo update that I download from Apple's support website, apple.com/support for OS X. Or just doing a restore of my iOS device in iTunes and restoring from backup. If that doesn't work, then you're looking at a clean install of the operating system on OS X or completely reinstalling the OS from scratch on your iOS device. And I think it goes without saying, but I'll remind everybody anyway, if you're going to get that far, if you're getting to that extreme of a fix, make sure that you have full backups of everything. You should have that already, but I'll just remind you of that. So hopefully that'll help you if you've run into any of these Wi-Fi issues. So a couple episodes ago, we had a question about how to extract an image, a contact photo from the address book, from the contacts application, excuse me, on your iOS device. This week, I received an email from John who asked a question about how do I copy a portion of a PDF page, part of a PDF, basically a snapshot, and save it as a picture into the photo library on the iPad. He said sometimes he needs to capture something out of a PDF that he might have, like a small diagram in a repair manual. He wants to send it off in an email, give it to someone, and was wondering how he could do that on his iPad. He mentioned that he uses GoodReader, and although GoodReader has a lot of functionality in terms of cropping PDFs, I played around with it a little bit, and it doesn't seem like you can extract, like, individual images. You can select copy, you can annotate text, you can do a lot of things with it, but it really didn't seem to have the ability to pull an image out. So John, I started doing some poking around or just thinking about this, and the first thing that I thought of is one workaround could be to just simply take a snapshot, take a screenshot on your iOS device, and then crop it in the photo app to get the portion of it that you need. So if you don't know how to do that, if you just press the home and sleep wake buttons together at the same time, you'll hear a little click. That takes a snapshot of what's ever on your screen at that moment, puts it into your camera roll, and then it's accessible from the photo application. You can go into the photo app now, use the cropping feature, and crop out the portion that you need to send in an email, and then you can start the email even right from the photo app. So I think that's going to work for you most of the time. If you truly want to extract the actual image that's embedded in the PDF, well, guess what? I told you earlier, our sponsor, Smile, they have PDF Pen for the iPad now. It's at that $10 introductory price, so a little bit pricier way to get at that. But PDF Pen for the iPad, if the PDF wasn't just a scan, So I have to be really specific about this. But if it was a PDF that was generated in an image layout application like InDesign, if it started life in Pages or something like that and got generated as a PDF, then there's a good possibility you could actually select the actual image that's embedded in that. If it was just an OCR or a scan from a scanner, then this trick is probably not going to work, and PDF Pen for the iPad is not going to help you. But with PDF Pen for the iPad, you can open that up, you can tap on the image, you'll actually be able to select it, and you can actually copy it. And then at that point, you can go over to your email, and you can just simply paste that image right into your email, and you could email it to yourself and then add it to the photo library. Or you could use, just like the last tip that we talked about, you could use an application like PasteBot to actually save the image directly back into the photo library. So one of those two tricks should work in your situation. I particularly like the PDF Pen version because it gives you the best quality image. Taking a screenshot, you're just going to have your iPad resolution. So if you have to, you know, scale into it or something like that, the quality may be questionable, but it'll work in a pinch for sure. So I really don't do a lot of product reviews on the MacCast. You know, that's mainly because they take a lot of time. I want to make sure I do my due diligence, and there's a lot of products out there to review, and there's actually a lot of sites and people out there doing reviews specifically that I think do a much better job than I can do. But every once in a while, a product comes along or there's a situation where you want to know about something, and I want to be able to deliver that to you. So one of the big things that happened when I went to Macworld this year is I asked you, what do you want to hear about? What kinds of products are you looking for when I go to Macworld? What do you want me to find? And everybody wanted Thunderbolt stuff, anything related to Thunderbolt. And on the show floor at Macworld this year, there was really only a couple of products, literally a couple of products. And I found those, a couple of hard drives, something from Seagate, something from Western Digital. And beyond that, Thunderbolt was nowhere to be found. Well, Elgato, which is one of my favorite companies, I love their video products. We talk about them on the Mac Mini as a home theater episodes, you know, the ability to turn your Mac Mini into a DVR using the Elgato iTV. Great product, a lot of fun. And they make great stuff. And they came out with, I think it was announced at CES, a Thunderbolt SSD drive. Very, very cool. Small, portable drive. It's 3.3 inches by 0.8 inches by 5.2 inches. So a little smaller than most portable USB FireWire external drives. They sent me one of them to play around with. Unfortunately, I have to send it back. I'd love to be able to keep this thing. It's so cool. But, you know, I took it out of the box. It is an all-metal enclosure. It's got fabulous construction, really, really well built. This great kind of black matte textured finish. It feels really nice in your hand. Also feels extremely just solid and rugged, exactly what you'd want in an SSD external hard drive. And something very cool about it is, as far as I know, the only external SSD solution out right now that is bus powered. There's a couple others out there, but I think you need to plug them actually into power. So that really lends to the portability of this drive. It's very simple in terms of the design. You take it out of the box, it's just the enclosure and just a single Thunderbolt port right there on the back of the device. Unfortunately, that means no daisy chaining on this one, which for me, when I was testing, I have a monitor plugged into my display port, which is the Thunderbolt port on my MacBook Pro. So I did have to disconnect my monitor to do testing. It would have been nice if I could have thrown that monitor on the end of the chain and continued to use it. But I think this is really designed to be a portable Thunderbolt solution. So not really a deal breaker in that regard. Another thing to know about it, though, is that it does not come with the cable. So it's BYOC, bring your own cable. If you don't have a Thunderbolt cable, you're going to want to order that from Apple at the same time you order this product or head down to your Apple retail store. It runs about $49 US from Apple. Elgato says the unit has an optimal data transfer rate of about 270 megabytes per second for data reads. So really great performance from a drive, blows away anything that you're going to get even on like FireWire 800. So I got the drive in. I wanted to do some of my own testing with it. So took it out of the box, got my cable, plugged it in, and I used the Blackmagic disk speed tests. And what that does basically is allows you to write and read a 5 gigabyte file. Actually, you can specify how big it was. In my case, I just did a 5 gigabyte test. So it will start running the test. It will create a 5 gigabyte file and copy that to the drive. And then it'll read that off the drive and then report back on the speed. And I wanted to have something to compare it to. So I used my OWC Mercury Elite Pro Mini. It's a 500 gigabyte, 5400 RPM FireWire 800 drive. So a traditional spindle drive, not that fast on the RPM. So I figure that is going to factor into the throughput, into the speed on that. The price point on the OWC drive is $140. To put that in perspective, the Elgato Thunderbolt SSD drive that they sent me is a 120 gigabyte model. It retails for $430. So quite a bit pricier, but this is SSD. So performance is going to be, you know, much improved over anything you're going to get with the 800. And my testing did show that. When I ran the speed tests on the Mercury Elite on the FireWire 800 drive, I got read and write times right about the same rate, 52 megabytes per second. When I plugged in the Elgato Thunderbolt, I got a read time of 211 megabytes per second. So what's that? Almost four times the read speed. On the write speed, though, I only got about double the rate. The write speed reported back at 114 megabytes per second. So I thought that was a little bit odd. I was wondering at that point if maybe there was some sort of bug in the Blackmagic speed test. So I wanted to do a couple other kind of real world tests, although I didn't know either how this would go, because I have a 2011 early 15-inch MacBook Pro. Its internal drive is a 500 gigabyte, 5400 RPM drive. Did the tests on that. It gave read-write speeds at around 45 megabytes per second. So my idea was that I would take a large video file. I had a 3.95 gigabyte M4V file. It was actually the Captain America movie. And I was going to take that and copy it from my internal hard drive to the OWC drive and to the Thunderbolt drive and just compare the copy to and copy from times. And when I did that, it turned out that I got almost exactly the same time reading and writing from either drive, either the FireWire 800 drive or the Thunderbolt SSD drive. So it was about 1 minute 17 seconds, 1 minute 18 seconds to copy to or from any one of those drives. And so at that point, I realized, well, you know, my bottleneck probably is my MacBook Pro, you know, that 5400 drive, 5400 RPM drive that's built into it. So I tried similar tests on my MacBook Air and actually got the same speed test results on that from the Blackmagic tests. So at this point, I'm kind of scratching my head and realizing there's got to be some sort of software thing. One thing that, as I was kind of researching this, I did note is that the Elgato SSDs are the 3G ones, not the 6G ones, which I guess will eke out a little more performance. But in doing the research, I ran across Barefeets, again, a great website for benchmarking. They do an awesome job, and they did a lot more extensive testing, had access to more tools than I did, and they ran the AJA tools, the AJA system tools, using a 4 gigabyte test file. And in their tests, they got closer to the specifications that Elgato was listing. So I reran the test using those tools in the 4 gigabyte test file. And in those tests, I ended up with a 241.6 megabyte per second write time and a 247.0 megabyte read time. So definitely getting more toward the performance that Elgato specified. So this is a, you know, a good, fast, very, very portable bus-powered Thunderbolt drive. And if that's what you're in the market for, Elgato has the solution for you. It does come at a price premium. So the 120 gigabyte model is $429.95. They also have a 240 gigabyte model, and that's $699.95. But if you want Thunderbolt and you want it now, this is what's available on the market. And I would say you can't go wrong. I mean, it is a good, solid product and performs to the specifications that Elgato is listing. So the last thing I have for you today is coming back to iCloud and Apple IDs, something that we've talked about on the show in the past. I have a feeling we're not going to be done talking about it for a while because it's confusing. Apple has set up a really bad situation with Apple IDs and iCloud and .Mac. Because it's been out there for so long, a lot of us have multiple IDs. If you're in a family, you might have different family members with Apple IDs. Some might be attached to iTunes accounts. Some might be attached to other kinds of accounts you've created for Apple. There's no way to merge those accounts. And so these questions keep coming up of how do I manage, how do I set up my Apple IDs? How do I set up iCloud if I'm in a family? How do I do all this stuff? And I keep getting these emails. So I thought we'd go over it again. And I thought we'd take the perspective of sort of how Apple seems to think it should be, and then what kind of the reality is. So I think in Apple's world, the way Apple would like to see it set up is that you would have a single Apple ID that is attached to everything. So that is your iTunes ID that you make all your iTunes purchases under. It's what you make all your app purchases under on the Mac App Store. It's the thing that's tied to your iCloud account, and it's your iCloud ID. And that's fine if you're just signing up for those services now. But if you've signed up for any one of these services in the past, it may be all but impossible to have that situation created. Some of us are lucky and maybe only ever had one Apple ID that's tied to iTunes that we then set up as our Mobile Me account and then converted to iCloud. If you're in that situation, great for you. You're going to have no problems with Apple's new model. But anybody else, you know, there's a lot of frustration. Apple does not give you any way to consolidate your Apple IDs or your iTunes account. So you're kind of stuck. So what is the reality for most people? Well, you have one or possibly more than one Apple ID. You maybe also have a .Mac, a Mobile Me, or an iCloud account that may or may not be that same Apple ID. Again, hopefully it is, and if you are, you're lucky. And then if you're not just by yourself, if you're not single and maybe you're in a family and your family members have Apple IDs, you might be in one of a couple different situations. Maybe you have an iTunes Apple ID that is one ID that's shared by all your family members, but potentially you have individual iTunes Apple IDs that are for each member of your family. So you all have different Apple IDs with different purchases under them, different music, different movies, different TV shows, books, app purchases, and it's all kind of spread out. And what people are finding now that Apple has moved to this model of, hey, look, we can re-download our apps. We can share our apps across multiple devices that are tied to the same account. We can share our music and our TV shows and our movies. If you're especially in that last situation where you have a family, very often you're going to want to let every member of your family have access to that purchased content. You don't want to have to rebuy the same things over under a different Apple ID just to get it onto different accounts. So what do you do? I mean, how do you handle all of this? And I was thinking about this, and I really think the best way to attack it or tackle it is from a problem sort of solutions approach. And what I mean by that is you need to assess what your particular situation is and then kind of make a plan of attack that's going to make the most sense for you. So if you're a single person and you have an iCloud and an iTunes account that are associated under the same Apple ID, you're golden. You're good to go. Just go about your business. Use your Apple ID. Your purchases will follow you along. Your stuff will sync. It'll all be tied into iCloud. If you are a single person and you have an iTunes Apple ID and then a different ID that is tied to your iCloud or your Mobile Me account, I think you're best off just continuing to keep them separated, not trying to necessarily consolidate them. And if you do that, what I would do is configure all of your iCloud services, so your calendar syncing, your email syncing, anything that's attached to iCloud or your Mobile Me account under that one account, and then keep your iTunes ID separate for making your iTunes purchases, your iBooks purchases, all those sorts of things. So you can configure the iCloud Apple ID to be separate from the iTunes Apple ID. And that's actually what I'm doing because what I ended up doing when the whole conversion happened is we had a single Apple ID that was our iTunes ID. And my wife and I shared that, and she did not have the Mobile Me services. I was lucky because I was the only one using the Mobile Me services. So when iCloud came along, rather than convert my existing Mobile Me ID over to an iCloud ID, what I did is I signed up for an iCloud account on my own and configured all my iCloud services under that. My wife signed up for her own new, now free iCloud account and set up all her syncing services and iCloud stuff under that account. And then we left the old Mobile Me account, which was the same Apple ID that's tied to my iTunes account, as that account. And we continue to share that. And what that has allowed us to do is continue to share our app purchases, our music purchases, our TV show purchases. Of course, she has her iTunes configured to sync up all of that stuff one way. I have my accounts set up to sync all that stuff the way I like it, and it works out very, very well. And so if you can do that, I think that's a great situation for families, because you can share your iTunes purchases. You can do iTunes in the cloud under that iTunes Apple ID and share that. You can do the iTunes match. You can do home sharing across all your devices under that one iTunes Apple ID, and then keep your iCloud syncing and all that stuff separate. The only downside that I've seen so far is that if you enable iTunes in the cloud auto downloads, you know, so auto download of app purchases or books or things like that, then everybody that's sharing that account, different family members, is going to get that content. And maybe you don't want that. Maybe you have a son or daughter who has a certain type of music that you don't necessarily like. So you're kind of locked out of that if you're sharing that one tune, that one iTunes Apple ID. So the potential way around that would be to have, you know, different iCloud accounts and different iTunes Apple IDs for every person in your family. And, you know, this can work if you only have a single person that does all of the purchasing, right? And downloads all the stuff. And then you can, you know, copy files over to another account and just authorize it in iTunes to work with that account. But it really does get tricky for families sharing content, because the minute someone purchases a different piece of content under a different ID, now there's a disconnect and there's no real way to consolidate that. So you're kind of stuck at that point. About the only exception is, of course, music, which has gone DRM-free. So anything that's purchased since Apple went DRM-free with the music, you can obviously just copy and share that across your iTunes sharing or your home sharing, or however you want to do that, just, you know, sneaker net it across. But, you know, for all the other content, the only workaround I can think of is that you could copy from one library to another and then authorize it under the different accounts. But you're going to have the username and password that content was purchased under. So that might be your wife's username and password, or your son or daughter's username and password. And as I said, it gets very confusing. But Apple does allow content to be authorized on up to 5 computers and on up to unlimited iOS devices. So you could still do your syncing, but every time, you know, you go through upgrade processes and stuff like that, you're going to have to reauthorize that stuff and deauthorize it and just manage it. And also, you won't be able to take advantage of the iTunes in the cloud services with multiple Apple IDs on a single Mac, because the minute you try and log into a different account, they lock you out. You can't switch accounts, or rather, you can't log in to a different iTunes ID to access Music Match and then switch back. There's a 90-day lockout, and that is to avoid piracy. So you can't take, say, my account credentials and get access to all my iTunes and the cloud music, download all that to your system, and then, you know, log out of that and go back to your original account. You'll be locked out of your music for 90 days. So that's not really conducive to a family sharing content. And I think Apple's got a real problem on their hands, and it's something they don't, at least not publicly, don't appear to be addressing. A lot of us, I think, are hoping in the background that Apple is thinking about this and thinking about some way for this content to be authorized under a family account, or be able to kind of push or group a bunch of accounts together and say, look, all of these accounts and all the purchases that go under these accounts belong to a single family and should be able to be shared across that. and get past some of this confusion. But bottom line, I think, you know, there's kind of two scenarios. If you're one person by yourself, I would recommend getting a single Apple ID and attaching that to iTunes and iCloud services. If you have a family or think that you will be in a situation where you're going to want to be able to share an iTunes account, Apple ID across multiple family members, I would keep that separate from your iCloud accounts and set those up separately. And so far that's worked out pretty well for me. So I hope that I'm probably just confused you even more than you were confused before, but it's confusing to me. It makes my head hurt to talk about this stuff, but hopefully I cleared up some of that confusion. If I didn't, feel free to email me, ask further questions, and I'll try and follow up. And if you have any tips and tricks and good recommendations for managing this stuff, I'd love to hear about them, because I think that this is really confusing for all of us. And all I can hope for is Apple sorting it all out somehow. All right, that is going to do it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at pharonix.com. Circus Ponies, they make Notebook, great application for taking notes and getting organized. You can get demos as well as more information over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out PDF Pen for iPad. Don't miss out on that limited time pricing, $10 on the App Store. Great product. Also check out all their other stuff over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you know, if you're thinking about getting one of those new iPads, you want to subsidize it, you can get cash for your old iPhones, iPods, iPads. All you have to do is head over to gazelle.com, do a simple search, and answer a few questions about condition of your item, and they will give you an upfront cash offer on that. Simple and easy to use, gazelle.com. And VMware, you know, it's discounted right now, $49.99 for the next month, and you can get 10% more off of VMware by using the code MACCAST. You can get information and details over at vmware.com/Mac. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. You can send questions, comments, reviews. If you found a great product you want to let us know about, let the community know about, send those along. I love getting them. If you do a review, that sort of thing, and you send me an audio attachment, if you can keep it around 3 minutes or so, that's usually a good time frame for running on the show, 3 to 5 minutes. And you can send those emails and those comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. I think the voicemail will actually cut you off at about 2 minutes, so just be aware of that. If you are planning a longer message, you probably want to just record it and attach it to an email and like an MP3 or something like that. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MACCAST. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MACCAST, or you can check out the MACCAST Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/TheMACCAST. And I'd love to have you join the fan community there if you get a chance. I try and post just fun Mac Apple stuff that I find as I'm doing research. A lot of videos and just different stories and stuff like that seem to go up there. So if you're just looking for that kind of content, check it out. And that'll do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.